Joe and Linda Murphy bought the Victorian home of their dreams in Marshalltown. They spent 3 years renovating the home, restoring it to its former glory, down to the very last detail. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In Robert Carr's novel, Completely Restored, the Murphy family finds that they have not only restored their home to its 1909 condition, they have transported themselves back in time as well. I'll talk with Carr about his novel and how he sees fiction as an avenue to preserve stories from the past. Later in the hour, the Burlington Historic Preservation Commission is undertaking an in-depth architectural survey of downtown Burlington. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In Robert Kerr's novel, Completely Restored, the Murphy family, parents Joe and Linda and their three kids, move into a turn-of-the-century Victorian house in Marshalltown that needs a lot of work. They spend 3 years restoring the home down to the very last detail, only to discover that they have transported themselves back in time to 1909. In the past, this fictional family encounters some very real people, or very real people, places, and events out of Iowa history. Robert Kerr is a school psychologist. This is his first novel. Hello, Robert.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And why don't you give us just a taste of the novel so we can set the stage a little bit?
So you'd like me to read a passage?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, I think this passage does a pretty good job of describing the situation the family started out in. Our time in Marshalltown had been good to us. Linda and I had three reasonably normal kids and one very odd dog. We would have had four kids, but, well, things happen. After that, Linda changed. She still had those moments of impishness when she would turn the slightest thing into a giggle and a giggle into convulsive laughter for both of us. She still had those moments, but they were a lot further apart. I thought that was how we became interested in the house in the first place. I thought Linda was looking for something to fill the void when she saw the ad for the beautiful three-story Victorian house in need of some TLC. We had admired the house from a distance for years, but never dreamed it could be ours. One peek inside, and that look returned to Linda's face for the first time since the baby. We had had other fixer-uppers before, but this one was different from the very beginning. It needed more work than any of the others, to be sure, but there was something else. It was as if the house pulled at our whole family. It was as if, excuse me, fate meant for us to live in that house. For one thing, all of our antiques fit perfectly into every room. We had just the right furniture and accent pieces for each room, right down to the fully outfitted dress mannequin Linda kept in our bedroom. I never quite got used to the idea of sex with her looking on. After researching the pattern at the local library, Linda found the perfect china in an antique shop. The house even had the right number of bedrooms for our family of five. Everything was perfect. Our 1908 Victorian was the house for showing off our antiques and collections, for reviving our passion for old things, for deepening our obsession with what we thought was a better time. The house was the perfect drug for our addiction. It was a match. It wasn't a match made in heaven, however. From the day we took possession of the house, Linda took charge. She cleaned, scrubbed, waxed, and straightened. She made lists of things to buy, things to fix, and things for me to do. By the end of that first summer, we had settled in, but we certainly weren't finished. By the first Christmas, I knew Linda wasn't going to slack off until she had completely restored the house to its original 1908 glory, from the cellar floor all the way up to the weather vane on top of the roof. At first, I thought finances would force some restraint. As educators, we didn't make much money. Time had an answer for that, too, when it ran out for Linda's great Aunt Mary late in 2007. Linda inherited enough dough to put all the kids through Iowa State twice. All that money went right into the house. As our money trickled into the house, our time poured into it as if it were some sort of time-sucking abyss. The summer we roofed and painted the house, we barely saw the kids or anyone else for that matter. Of course, Sammy stayed confined to our yard, but Abby and Nate left shortly after they were dressed and never returned until long after we were in bed. The house took over our lives, and we just went along for the ride. But the time we were reaching the end of the restoration in the spring of 2009, we could not have predicted where that ride would take us.
That's Robert Kerr reading from his novel Completely Restored, a historical novel, a fictional family restoring a Victorian house, and they encounter some very real people from Iowa's past when they get transported back in time. Robert, reading your book, it sounds like it's written by someone who has experienced historic preservation and renovation of a home. Is this something that your family has done, and have you experienced that time suck?
Well, yes, I have. My wife and I both have. I think I'd have to say that I have been cursed with just enough skill to be able to do some of these projects. I'm certainly not a professional restorer, but I know enough to putty a window, or you know, paint the house and build a deck and those sorts of things. And all of the homes that we've owned have received that kind of care from us, whether they actually needed it or not. I'm not sure everyone would agree. But I certainly have had that experience.
What gave you the idea for this story?
Well, one house in particular. In the 80s, the early 80s, we purchased what I suppose most people would call a Sears and Roebuck house. It was a craftsman-style home. It was identical to many homes in Marshalltown. We poured, I think it was about $10,000 into it, hundreds and hundreds of hours. And 5 years after we purchased it, when we wound up selling it, we were forced to take $500 less than we had paid for it because of the way the market was going in the 80s. I was kind of glad to be rid of it. And several years down the road, my wife and I were having breakfast one summer morning, and she got this kind of funny look on her face, and I could tell she was dreaming about something. And I said, well, what are you thinking about? She said, oh, I just really miss that old house. And I had just taken a sip of coffee, which I promptly spit across the table. And I said, I can't believe you would say that. And then I added, anyone who would want to live in a house that old ought to have to live in a year in the time when the house was built. And I thought I had, you know, made my point, and she came back with this even more dreamy-eyed look and said, oh, boy, that would make a great story. Well, the more I thought about it, the more I thought my wife was right, which is, I'd have to say, usually the case. I had started learning about Marshalltown history shortly after we moved there in 1976, and I had always wanted to write about some of the things that I had learned about, but I really didn't have an idea of how to go about it. I'm not a historian. I'm a lover of history, and I think there's a big difference. I also like a good story, and when she gave me that suggestion, I pretty quickly realized that I had what I needed in order to be able to put the two things together.
When you started trying to put this down on paper and came upon the idea of this family is living in Marshalltown in 2009 and they get transported back 100 years to 1909, the part of the year where they were living in 2009, exactly 100 years earlier. When you had that idea, did you then set about researching Marshalltown in 1909?
Oh, boy, did I. In fact, when people ask me how long it took to write the story, I'm almost ashamed to admit how many years I spent in that phase. We had that conversation, my wife and I did, about 1997, as near as I can tell. And I kind of dabbled in the research, and it seemed like every time I would learn about a new facet of life in Marshalltown in that 1909-1910 time period, it would just open up more and more things for me to learn about. And I guess the short answer is I procrastinated by enjoying the research. I definitely did do a lot of research. I read more pages of the Marshalltown Times-Republican on microfiche than my eye doctor would have advised. And that's where I got most of the information.
It sounds like you enjoy historical research the way your wife enjoys an old house.
I think that's a fair assessment, yes.
As you started to dig into this history, were you surprised by anything?
I was very surprised by, I guess, each new item that I unearthed in the research. When we moved to Marshalltown, or very shortly after we did, I, of course, heard about the Reverend Billy Sunday, as most people in Iowa have heard of him. I was surprised to find that Marshalltown had its own very, very famous magician, T. Nelson Downs. I was surprised by things like when I learned how the extent to which Marshalltown was a manufacturing hub in that time period. A friend of mine, Richard Huff, and his wife Marlis gave us quite a bit of information for my research, indicated that his research said that there had been over 50 manufacturing plants in Marshalltown at the turn of the last century. And I have seen a photograph of Marshalltown at that time period, and it was virtually just a jungle of smokestacks, particularly on the east side.
You also, in writing about Marshalltown during that time, you write about the smell of Marshalltown during that time. Was that something that you came up with thinking about what it must have smelled like with all of these different manufacturing plants, or was that something that you found in historical records?
Well, I didn't actually find a recording of that. I assumed that was something that no one wanted to brag about. But when we moved to Marshalltown in 1976, the building that had held the vinegar works was still standing across from Stone's Restaurant. And at that time, it contained an antique furniture refinishing shop. But some of the vinegar vats were still in there. And I knew about that. And then people such as Mr. Huff had talked to me about what it was like growing up in Marshalltown. So I assumed that that was something that anyone going through that part of town would have encountered.
Would have noticed. How did you decide what historical people and actual facts you wanted to include in your novel?
Well, I think I always wanted to focus on the appearance of the Reverend Billy Sunday, who happened to be in Marshalltown in the spring of 1909. He was there for 6 weeks. That was sort of a focal point or an anchor. And then beyond that, I just included the characters or events that happened to actually take place or visit Marshalltown during that approximately a year that I had the family stationed there, you might say, because of the travel back in time. I tried to depict things in real time. In other words, have them occurring in the story on the same day or at the same time they occurred in history, to the extent that I could. And I'll admit I did take some license, but I tried to stay on the mark.
I'm talking with Robert Kerr. He's the author of Completely Restored. It's a fictional novel, but there are some real people, places, and events from Iowa history that he works into his story. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. And later in the hour, the Burlington Historic Preservation Commission is undertaking an in-depth architectural survey of downtown Burlington. We'll find out more. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, the Burlington Historic Preservation Commission is doing an in-depth architectural and historical survey of downtown Burlington. We'll talk about what they're hoping to find, what volunteers can do to help out, and what it might mean for the community in the future. That's coming up in a few minutes. Right now, my guest is Robert Kerr. He is the author of a book called Completely Restored. And this book is about a family that restored an old Victorian house in Marshalltown, restored it to its original condition. The house was built in 1908, and they discovered that they were transported back in time 100 years to 1909 after they finished their restoration project. And during their time back in 1909, this family encounters a number of real people, places, and events that took place in Iowa history. Robert, as you were researching these stories and putting them into your novel, it sounds like you really found a mission in preserving some of these stories that aren't getting told about Iowa history.
Well, I would say I did. I actually started out to be a history teacher many, many years ago and got lost along the way. My wife, Joan, taught in Marshalltown, and I kind of had a – and I worked in Marshalltown schools. I kind of had a sense for what was being discussed in classrooms in Marshalltown and around Iowa. And it seems as time goes on, less and less emphasis is placed on our heritage, our historical heritage in Iowa, as far as school curriculum, for various reasons. I wanted, among other things, to produce a story that might stir the interests of people in learning more about their historical heritage, not only in Marshalltown, but in Iowa in general. And I hope I accomplished that by bringing the few characters and events together that I brought together in the book.
Well, I think, of course, a lot of us know at least a little bit about the Reverend Billy Sunday and his connection to Iowa. That's one of those stories that does pop up in Iowa history. But there are a few stories that you incorporate into the novel that really don't get included as part of an Iowa history curriculum. And with as little time as teachers can spend in the classroom on that, I guess you wouldn't probably expect to learn about a famous magician from Marshalltown, for example. Why is it important to preserve stories like his?
Well, I'll use my own family as an example. Both of my kids, one time or another, did the thing that a lot of teenagers do, and that was to sort of look down on their hometown or their home state. And, you know, we heard the whole thing about there's nothing to do here, there's nothing exciting, etc. Of course, as they got older, they realized that that wasn't necessarily the case. But I would like to believe that if young people were aware of some of the things that had already happened here, some of the really memorable things, some of the great people that grew up and reached adulthood in the central Iowa area, they might have a little different appreciation for what life can be here. That's one of my goals. And I guess the other thing is I just think it's the right thing to do to honor our heritage historically and celebrate some of the things that have happened and perhaps learn from the experiences of people that have gone before.
I'm talking with Robert Kerr about his novel Completely Restored. And we'd love to hear from you. If there's a moment in Iowa history or a person from Iowa history that you think is overlooked, the story that is not being told, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what story you think should be preserved in any way, through fiction or through nonfiction or just by having this conversation today. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So as you were doing your research and you found out about T. Nelson Down, this magician known as the King of Coins, what did you learn about him?
Well, first, I guess I was surprised to know that he had been from Marshalltown or that we had had a magician of some notoriety from Marshalltown. But the most surprising thing I learned was just how widely revered he is by modern-day practicing magicians. Without question, everything that I read about him that came from modern-day magicians indicated that they feel he's the most famous, most skilled magician who ever lived. And when you're in the company of people like the great Blackstone or Houdini, that's saying quite a lot. In his time, when he was performing, he performed on the same playbills as Houdini. At some point in his career, the Marshalltown newspaper, the Times-Republican, dubbed him the King of Coins because coin manipulation became one of his specialties. He also did card tricks. Houdini, when he started, appeared under the name the King of Cards, and they appeared together on the same playbills. Some of the tricks that were described in the books that Mr. Downs wrote about his magic accomplishments just defy the imagination. Of course, I was not able to actually see them. There is a video on YouTube would have been taken, you know, in the days of silent film that shows him doing a few coin manipulations. But to my knowledge, there's no filming of his more famous tricks. For example, he could palm up to 60 coins at a time. He used specially made coins that were very thin. And this allowed him to do a trick known as the miser's dream, in which he would reach into thin air and pull a coin out of the air and throw it into his top hat, and the audience would count the coins as he threw them in. And he could do that almost with it. It seemed as though he could do that almost without end, but he could actually palm a total of 60.
As this story lived in your brain for at least a decade before you published this book was published in 2009, who did you envision as the audience for it?
Well, I guess I thought certainly people from Central Iowa. I really thought it would be of more interest to the male part of the population, I guess because of the emphasis on the restoration of the house and so on. I find a lot of young women as well as older women are the ones who are purchasing it. Many times they're purchasing it as a gift for the husband in the family or the grandfather or whatever. But I think a lot of the people in Central Iowa who have an appreciation for times past and some of the events that maybe have gone uncelebrated, some of the individuals, those are the people that I hoped would pick up a copy and enjoy it.
As a plot element in the story, one of the characters becomes ill, and we get a glimpse of what medicine was like in 1909. Their next door neighbor is a doctor, so that's something that comes up again and again. But I was curious about your choice of including that in the novel. Was that something that you wanted to demonstrate to people to just reinforce how different our medical system was 100 years ago and how a fairly treatable disease today could be a death sentence back then?
That's exactly why I included it. Why I picked that particular condition, I suppose, had to do with the fact that my great-grandfather died of it. And as you said, it would have been widely or is widely treated now. I wanted to show that that time period, like all time periods, had its pluses and minuses. And as you see when you read the story, the family was less than pleased to find out that they had been thrown back in time 100 years, largely because all they could think of was what they would miss out on. Eventually, they begin to see that there were some advantages to that time period. Life was simpler. It was easier to live. They became almost comfortable, but they also had to wrestle with the fact that there were some real shortcomings to life then. And your mention of the medical treatments available would be definitely one of those shortcomings.
I love the part where they have to dress in, of course, the clothing of the time, but they get to keep their modern underwear. I think that could make anyone enjoy 1909 a lot more than if you had to embrace wool underwear.
Well, that was certainly my feeling.
When you were thinking about details like that, did you try to research what was being sold in stores at Marshalltown?
I did. It was very easy to find ads from the stores. I think maybe there were more display ads in the newspaper in that era than there might be currently. So that was one source of help. And then just as for general information, I did turn to one of the old Sears catalogs from the 1909-1910 era just to get a feel for what kinds of things were actually available then.
There was another plot element in the story taken from history, and I don't want to give anything away, but there was a terrible train wreck near Marshalltown. Is that something that living in Marshalltown, is that something that you learned about?
Actually, I learned about it when I was doing research for the book. It was the worst rail disaster in Iowa history. It happened on March 21st, 1910. There was an observation of it, a 100-year observation of it, back in 2010, and I was present for that. at the Fisher Community Center in Marshalltown. I have no idea what the capacity of that building is, but it was near double capacity crowd, standing room only. And people were just hungry to hear David Shearer, the presenter, talk about the train wreck. And I was amazed because, like I said, I didn't learn about it until I was doing the research. And very few of the people that I mentioned it to in Marshalltown knew about it. But I think that's one of those things that's kind of a shame. There's a marker on the site, and it gets very little traffic or attention.
It was not something that I learned about in Iowa history growing up. In fact, I learned about it from your book. Tell us, for people who may not be familiar with it, tell us what happened that day.
Well, basically, it was a series of unfortunate events. The day before, which I believe was Palm Sunday that year, there was a freight train derailment in Shellsburg, Iowa, and that caused the main line that trains coming from Chicago or St. Louis would take through Cedar Rapids and on up into St. Paul, caused that to be closed for many weeks. So the next day on Monday morning, these two trains from St. Paul or from Chicago and one from St. Louis were both trying to get to St. Paul, and the railroad that they were on sought permission from the railroad in Marshalltown to run them up the diagonal tracks that run from Marshalltown to Waterloo, or I should say ran. They've been removed. And would take the train through Green Mountain and Gladbrook. In that time period, there was no good way to turn the engines around in Marshalltown. They didn't have a roundhouse, and they thought the engines were too heavy for the Y that they had. So they made the decision once they arrived in Marshalltown to disconnect the cars and back the two engines with the coal tender preceding the engine, and there were two engines and coal tenders. And then they placed the cars behind the rear-facing engines. That was one factor. The other one was that even though they knew this at the time, they made the decision to put the wooden passenger cars from one train ahead of the steel Pullman cars of the other train. And they knew from experience that if they did that and there were would be a derailment, it was likely that the steel Pullman cars would destroy the wooden cars. Another fateful part of this event was the fact that experience taught them that if they were backing a coal tender ahead of an engine, that they dare not go much faster than 10 or 15 miles per hour. But in reality, these two trains were hours late before they left Marshalltown. And when they look at the time that it pulled out of the station and the distance it covered and the time when the derailment occurred, 8:16 a.m., math tells us that they had to be going close to 25 miles per hour. So either the coal tender jumped the track or maybe there was a bad rail. They never really did determine the cause. But the result was a total of 54 people were killed as a result of the accident directly, and an additional 3 people died indirectly as a result of the accident.
Why did you decide to write about all of these historical events in a fictional novel as opposed to working on a nonfiction history of the area?
Well, Charity, that question has come up in my own mind many times as I was attempting to finish this. I guess I started thinking that they were interesting stories and they would add to the enjoyment of a story about a family who had been thrown back in time 100 years. But in reality, any one of them would make a very interesting nonfiction work should someone decide to undertake it. And I guess that's one of my hopes for the book, is that maybe some younger people who read it or even adults would decide that these stories that I've touched on and described briefly do in fact merit a full scale treatment.
Do you have other ideas for other novels kicking around in your mind?
I am working on a sequel to this in which the father, Joe, and the son, Nate, are making a birthday celebration trip to Cedar Falls to go to the Clear Lake, to go to the winter dance party to celebrate Nate's 16th birthday. And they take their 1965 Thunderbird with them. Unfortunately, along the way, they cross over in time into 1959, and they wind up being present for the original winter dance party with Buddy Holly and the rest of the crew. To make matters more interesting, on the way, they unknowingly traipse through a crime scene, and when they get to Clear Lake, Nate is charged with murder and some other very serious crimes. And the father, who cannot explain why he's driving a car that won't be made for 6 or 7 years, and he has 2012 registration papers in his car, gives some very frustrated explanations, and he winds up in the local mental hospital ward.
Oh, wow. Well, we can't wait for that one. Thank you, Robert Kerr.
Thank you.
Robert Kerr is the author of Completely Restored. You can find out more about the novel if you go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, the Burlington Historic Preservation Commission is undertaking an in-depth architectural survey of downtown Burlington. We'll talk about what they're looking for, what they hope to find, and what it might mean for the community. Also, how you can get involved in the effort. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Burlington Historic Preservation Commission has received a grant to do an in-depth survey of historic architecture in downtown Burlington. The project is designed to find properties that could potentially be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The survey has just begun and will be completed, hopefully, by December. With me right now is Steve Frevert. He is the chair of the Burlington Historic Preservation Commission. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And also Rebecca Lowen McCarley is here. She's been hired to lead the effort. She's a historic preservation consultant based in Davenport. Her business is Spark Consulting. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Charity. Thanks for having me as well.
Well, thank you for being here. And Steve, why don't you describe the area that you're really going to be looking at for us?
We have a downtown of about 42 blocks, and really a number of areas of that downtown are already on the National Register of Historic Places. We're going to be looking specifically at blocks east of 4th Street, which kind of is one of the major north-south streets in our downtown. So from 4th Street over to the river, all the way basically from Highway 34 south to our new manufacturing and wholesale historic district.
Give us an idea of how many properties might be involved in this survey.
I believe Rebecca says 78.
All right. And Rebecca, as you're beginning to look at these different properties, what exactly are you looking for?
We are going through and researching the history of the various businesses that have been in the buildings, as well as the person who built the building originally, and looking at that from a historical standpoint in terms of what significant history might be represented within these buildings. We are also looking at the architecture of the buildings in terms of what the original architectural style and features were, what changes have happened over time, either historic changes or non-historic changes, and assessing which of those buildings might have some architectural significance, either in addition to historic significance or instead of historic significance. So we're getting at it from both the angle of history and architecture.
Steve, is there information missing in Burlington that makes a survey like this necessary?
It's not such much a question of missing information. It's a question of gathering different facts together so we have a better picture of and a better understanding of our historic downtown. I think we all recognize that we have a very historic downtown area here, but it's a lot better when you can bolster that with facts and figures and a complete architectural and historic assessment.
And Rebecca, when you start to look at a property, where do you start?
We start at the beginning. We go down to the courthouse and use the property owner transfer records. We go over to the library. We take a look at the Sanborn fire insurance maps, the city directories, The newspapers, the county histories, all these sort of historic resources come together in terms of piecing together the various history of these buildings.
And what makes a property worth looking into? Is there something that you see or just the age of the property that makes you think this is something we need to research?
For a survey project, how it's designed is to research every single building that's within a particular survey boundary. And so we have 78 properties that we've identified within our particular survey boundary, and we're doing research on all of those properties. It's through the research process that we will begin to identify which ones of those might stand out among others within that particular boundary. But they all get research done.
And 78 properties is a lot of research to do. And Steve, you're asking for volunteers to assist with that part of the process?
Yeah, we do have seven commissioners on the City's Historic Preservation Commission, and all of them will be working on this. As you said, 78 properties, when you do in-depth research, it takes some time. We're definitely looking for volunteers to help in that process.
And do these people need to be people who've been involved in historic preservation before? Or if somebody's interested, they can just give you a call?
Absolutely, yeah. All you have to have is an eagerness to learn, and Rebecca does a fine job training people on exactly how to do the research and how to fill out the forms. And that's all it requires is curiosity.
How many people have volunteered so far?
I think we've got about
14.
Oh, is that many?
We have a total of 14 volunteers, including the commission members, who are currently working on the project. We had a kickoff training meeting a week ago Tuesday that we went over a lot of the initial research methodology and what we're going to be looking for in terms of doing the research on the buildings, and had a great attendance at that particular session, and had a lot of people in Burlington interested in working on the project.
And Rebecca, you're based in Davenport. How familiar are you with Burlington starting off this project?
Well, I worked on a previous survey project back in Burlington in 2009 to 2010. They were looking at the area just south of our current survey area, which was kind of dubbed the Warehouse District area. We went through and did a similar survey process back then, identified the history and the significance of buildings in that particular section of kind of south of downtown Burlington. Through that survey project, we identified a historic district, and so they received a grant to, again, hire me to go back in for a second project and do a nomination for the Manufacturing and Wholesale Historic District, which Steve mentioned was just officially listed here on the National Register a couple weeks ago on June 12th.
Given that initial experience in Burlington, were there a couple properties that caught your eye that you really couldn't wait to dig into when you got back?
There are a number of interesting properties in downtown Burlington. There are some older properties from the late 19th century that kind of catch your eye in terms of the intricacies of the architectural detail. And there are some later properties from the early and middle of the 20th century, including a number of banks that were built in Burlington kind of in the middle of the 20th century that are kind of interesting from an architectural history standpoint.
I should add that the buildings, those 78 buildings and properties that are going to be surveyed, really range in age back to the 1840s. We have a set of federal-style buildings on North Main Street that will be part of the survey, all the way to, I think maybe our public library is 6 years old. So, we'll be looking at, basically 150, 160 years worth of architecture downtown.
If you have a favorite building in downtown Burlington that you've wondered about the history of that, you can call in and share that with us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Rebecca, you're researching the history of these buildings. To what end? Some of these might end up being listed on the National Historic Register, but what are you hoping to find out, and what is the next step?
The primary goal of the survey project is to identify if there is most likely an extension of one of the current historic districts or an overlay of a new commercial historic district in downtown Burlington. We'll be looking at buildings on whether or not they're individually significant, but primarily our goal is to identify if there is a historic district within this area and then whether or not those buildings contribute to the historic district. We've gone through and done a lot of that sort of research when we did the manufacturing and wholesale historic districts and picked out those buildings that were contributing within that district as well as one building that was outside that district. And that's kind of the second layer of this project that we're working on right now is an actual National Register nomination for the Largo Mochino Group Company building, which is just south of our current survey area. So it was in our previous survey area at the corner of Valley and Front Street. So that sort of project might end up being followed up with some of the other buildings within the downtown area as well.
So, Steve, if you extend a historic district or you have a new designation for a historic district, what does that mean?
Well, yeah, the benefits are many, and you know, there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about what it means to be in a historic district, and I have people tell me that it means that they have to open their building to the public anytime somebody asks, or it has to be painted a particular color or restored, you know, at a private expense, and none of those things are correct. Being on the National Register is really an honorific. It designates a property due to its local, statewide, or national significance, but it doesn't place any restrictions on the property. That only takes place if a property is locally designated by a city's Historic Preservation Commission or if federal money is going to be used to affect a National Register property. However, there are a lot of benefits to it. A building on the National Register is eligible for national or for federal and statewide historic rehab tax credits. Definitely helps us stabilize and perhaps increase property values. It can help attract heritage tourism. And, of course, by keeping these buildings maintained and occupied, it helps promote economic activity and keeps them out of the landfill as well.
Have you had, you mentioned some people are a little nervous about it. Have you had people in businesses say, I really don't want you to come in and look at our building?
No, we haven't. We had, I think when we went around on the manufacturing and wholesale district, we had one or two people who came to the informational meetings just to find out more about it. But once they realized that this wasn't a big government intrusion, they were okay with it. They were actually kind of curious to learn more about their buildings.
Rebecca, we've talked about the research that needs to be done into, you know, who owned a property and the deeds and the transfers and all of that. When you actually go to a site to look at the architecture, what are you looking at?
I'm looking at just kind of the building as a whole in terms of getting an idea of what parts of the building are original and what parts of the building are changed. I'm looking at the particular details on the building, the particular materials, if it still has its original wood windows, or if the windows have been swapped out in time. For these downtown buildings, we're looking at the storefront area. That was a very common area to get updated as buildings progress through time. And a lot of those storefront updates that might date to the 1920s or 1930s or 1940s are considered historically significant changes in terms of the architecture of the building. So we're taking a close look at those and what materials are used and what styles from that period, as well as perhaps from the earlier period of construction of a particular building.
Is there a particular architect or a couple of architects who did a lot of work in this area?
There are a couple architects that were based in Burlington that most likely did some of the buildings within this area. Since we haven't really delved deep into the research yet, I'm afraid I can't tell you if there's a particular one that did a number of buildings or if just a couple of the standard architects did most of the ones that are known to be credited to particular architects.
Well, Steve, as a member of the Historic Preservation Commission, I'm sure you have been looking at a lot of these buildings for a long time. Are there a couple buildings that you're really interested in finding out the history of in more detail?
Well, all of them is the short answer. and since I'm actually looking at these buildings on my window right now, I'm the Main Street Director for Downtown Partners, which is Burlington's downtown revitalization program. So I have a professional interest in this as well. I think the F&M Bank building is a beautiful historic building, very prominent on the corner of 3rd and Jefferson. It'd be interesting to find out more about the architecture and the architects on that. I know that the original architectural plans were not used, and they ended up going with a different architect, so I'd like to find out a little bit more about that. As I mentioned, there's a block of four 1840s era federal style buildings on Main Street that I've always been curious about. They've been changed a bit over time, but we really don't know a whole lot about their history. And there's some really standout buildings, the Burlington Medical Arts Building, the Schramm Building we know was redesigned by Holobert and Root, which was a well-known architectural firm out of Chicago. So there's a real variety of stuff out there, and it'll be interesting to see what we pull out of the archives.
Rebecca, this project is going on for almost 6 months. How much of your time are you devoting to downtown Burlington over that time?
I think it's probably going to be around 275, 300 hours over the course of the project. The project actually is funded by a certified local government grant, which is a grant that is passed down to the State Historic Preservation Office from the National Park Service. And those particular grants run on fiscal year cycles. And so we're hoping to get done with most of the survey effort and the draft report, like you say, within the next 6 months. And then the kind of the final touches on the project will be happening throughout next spring so that we get done by the end of our fiscal year deadline next June.
You mentioned earlier that you have 14 volunteers already. Are you looking for more volunteers still? Do you need more manpower?
We can always use more people. We'll have people that may get started on the project and have something come up and not be able to devote as much time as they had originally thought. And so we'll need people to kind of swap in and swap out. When we get to later on this fall, we'll be looking for people in particular to go around and take photographs of each of these buildings. And so we'll be specifically recruiting volunteers in that capacity come October or November. We always can use more. We also can use building owners who might know something about the history of just their particular building, or people in or around Burlington or who once lived in Burlington who have historic photographs of the downtown area. We really use these historic photographs in terms of dating some of these building changes that I was mentioning, in terms of maybe the storefront was remodeled or the upper stories were changed out in some way. And so we need some people who might just be able to volunteer the use of their photographs or the use of their information that they already have collected in terms of being able to contribute something towards the history of a particular building that's included within this project.
And if there are people listening right now who may have some of that information, how do they get in touch with you?
They can give me a call, Rebecca McCarley with Spark Consulting in Davenport. They can give Steve Freever or Eric Teisland a call with the City of Burlington's Historic Preservation Commission. Our information's pretty readily available online.
All right. And Steve, this survey is hopefully going to wrap up in December. What happens then?
We do all the volunteer work, and then Rebecca gets the joy of putting it all together and deciphering and writing and putting it into a draft report that goes on to the State Historic Preservation Commission or State Historic Preservation Office. This intensive survey kind of sets the stage for figuring out what buildings may be eligible for the National Register. So I would anticipate that once this is concluded that we will go on and apply for a CLG grant to nominate the worthy buildings to the National Register.
All right, Steve Freebert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Steve Freebert is the chair of the Burlington Historic Preservation Commission. Rebecca McCarley, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebecca McCarley has been hired to lead the effort. Her business is Spark Consulting, based in Davenport. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today from John Pemble in Des Moines. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow is Horticulture Day. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.